Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. Today I'm going to cover 1 Samuel chapter 19, the whole chapter, verses 1 through 24. We will entitle this chapter, Saul Tries to Kill David. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 18, we examined David's complicated relationships with his king Saul, Saul's son Jonathan, and Saul's daughter Michal. He married Michal. He entered into a covenant of friendship with Jonathan, and Saul has tried to kill him. In fact, Saul had tried to throw a spear at David and pin him against the wall when David was playing the harp for Saul. That's in the last chapter, chapter 18. Also, Saul reassigned David, made him commander of 1,000 men so that David would go out and fight the Philistines and hopefully, from Saul's point of view, get killed. So Saul's getting really evil and nasty now, and it comes to a head in this chapter, chapter 19. We start with 1 Samuel 19, verses 1 through 3. Now Saul told Jonathan his son and all his servants to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. If I found out anything, then I will tell you. Now the first question we have is, why in the world would Saul tell Jonathan of a plot to kill David? Did not Saul know that Jonathan was tight with David and that he might spill the beans? Well, here's some possible answers to that. Saul knew that Jonathan was the successor to the throne, and therefore Jonathan had an interest in keeping David away from the throne. So if Jonathan was as selfish and greedy as Saul was, perhaps Saul thought, well, Jonathan will be happy about putting David to death because then David will not usurp Jonathan from the throne, just as he will not usurp Saul from the throne. Well, that's one possible reason. It could be also that Saul thought Jonathan would listen to a father rather than a friend. I'm your father, Jonathan. You need to listen to me. Or maybe Saul thought, well, look, I'm telling all my servants to put David to death. I might as well tell Jonathan. He's going to find out anyway, even if there's a risk that Jonathan might tell David. But for whatever reason, Saul did tell Jonathan, as well as all of his other court officials, let's find David and put him to death. Now, when it says all his servants, of course, that means all the servants who didn't love David. There were some that did. David was now in desperate trouble for his life. Usually when a king dispatches his servants to kill someone, they are as good as dead. David was in deep doo-doo. Saul was trying to put David to death like David was a traitor. But it actually was because of Saul's jealousy. Remember in the last chapter, verse 7, the women were celebrating, singing, Saul has killed his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And plus, David was going out and killing a lot of Philistines. Saul, meanwhile, was back at the palace having hallucinations and insane ravings. So, it wasn't because David was a traitor, it's because Saul was a jerk that he was trying to put David to death. So Jonathan immediately runs to tell David, and he says, look, be on guard in the morning, which makes me think that Saul had told all of his servants at nighttime to go, that they were going to kill David. And again, that would be in the morning, in the daytime. They're not going to do it at night. And so Jonathan took advantage that it was still nighttime, and he went to tell David, to warn David. Now, what Jonathan was probably figuring here, if he could keep David alive till morning, Saul might change his mind, which as a matter of fact, he did. Saul, having slept on his plot for a night, might think the better of it the next day. Maybe he'll have a moment of lucidity in the morning. So I'm assuming here that the order to kill was to kill him in the daytime the next morning. It's much easier to do it in the daytime so there are no mistakes made. We get the right guy and so forth. Harder for him to hide in the daytime than at night. Now this idea of the field in verse 3, Jonathan says, I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are. So in other words, they arrange for a spot in the field. David's hiding in a cave or behind a rock somewhere, and Jonathan takes Saul out there to talk to him, and he manages to get Saul close enough to where David can overhear. Now, he doesn't say anything about overhearing in verse 3. He just says, if I find out anything from Saul, I will tell you. I'll pass it along. But they also worked it out where David could actually overhear what Saul was saying firsthand. And so then David would know whether it was safe to remain in the kingdom or whether it was time to get out of Dodge. At least that's what a lot of people say, but I don't think so. Here's what Colin Delick say about that. David was to conceal himself in the field near to where Jonathan would converse with his father about him, not that he might hear the conversation in his hiding place, but that Jonathan might immediately report to him the result of his conversation without there being any necessity for going far away from his father so as to excite suspicion that he was in league with David. And I think that makes a lot of sense, especially when we look down at 1 Samuel 19, verse 7, we see Jonathan doing this. So Jonathan summoned David and told him all the words of Saul. Well, what's the point of telling David if David had overheard the words of Saul in the field? There would be no need for Jonathan to tell him. But Jonathan did tell him. So I don't think the point of hiding David in the field was so that he could overhear Saul. It was so that he would be conveniently placed so Jonathan could get to him without arousing suspicion and could get to him quickly. We go down to 1 Samuel 19, verses 4 through 6. Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, "Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause?" Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. And Saul vowed, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." A vow, a solemn vow, "As the Lord lives," which Saul immediately broke as he continually tried to kill David, as we'll see. So when did this little speech of, this little talk of Jonathan to his father pumping up David happened? It says then. Well, that means the next morning after the nighttime was over, they were in the field. Jonathan appeals to David's deeds. What deeds? Well, he's been slaying all these Philistines in the last chapter. Also, he played the harp and he soothed Saul's troubled soul. And remember, David's a big shot. He's a military leader. He doesn't have to be hanging around playing a harp. But he did it anyway. And not only that, he killed Goliath, which was the first and big victory over the Philistines that Israel had had in a while. And David did that. So Jonathan is appealing to David's past record. He says in verse 5, "For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine." I think that stands for Goliath. Doesn't necessarily. It could just mean Philistines in general. But I think it's talking about Goliath in particular. "The Lord brought about a great deliverance. Remember, the Philistine army fled when they saw Goliath dead. And the Israelite army chased them for about 10-mile radius as the Philistine army panicked and fled all the way up north to Bethaven," it says. Well, Saul listened to that, verse 6, and he said, he vowed, "He shall not be put to death." Oh, that makes a good sense. It's a good sense, Jonathan. You can see now Saul is pretty erratic now. He goes one way, he goes the other. He's a moron. Now this vow, "As I live, as the Lord lives," a vow made in the name of Yahweh, he broke it. He attempted to murder Rotten. That's one more example of Saul's rotten character. Now the question is, what was Saul's state of mind here? Did he really intend to keep that vow but then changed his mind later on? I think so. It could be he never intended to keep the vow. He gave the vow with a view to deceive Jonathan, knowing that Jonathan's going to go tell David what's going on. Well, we'll leave that up in the air. We don't know. But I think Saul really meant to keep the vow. He's erratic. We go now to verses 7 and 8 of 1 Samuel 19. "Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in the presences formerly." David was in Saul's presences formerly. "When there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter so that they fled before him." Well, things are back to normal. I wonder whether David and Saul both openly acknowledged that Saul had thought to kill David. I mean, it's sort of awkward. David's working for a king who's tried to kill him, and he knows that Saul has given a directive to all of his courtiers and court officials to kill him, and he's still faithfully serving in the military and faithfully serving as an official in Saul's palace and faithfully playing the harp before Saul when Saul started acting batty at night. I would imagine they both just kept quiet about it. David's probably thinking, "Well, Saul's nuts. He tried to kill me, but he was nuts. He's insane, so I'm going to forgive him." At any rate, David goes out and fights with his 1,000 soldiers, fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter. So he's still doing well. He's killing his 10,000s while Saul is acting nutty in the palace or in his home in Gibeah. We go now to 1 Samuel 19, verses 9 through 10. Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. And by the way, when God puts an evil spirit on somebody, it's not because God is being arbitrary. It's because the person deserves it and he's getting punished. You want to open yourself up to the devil? Well, you will get the devil. I have talked to people who've been deep in the New Age movement, and boy, did the devils come and give them hell, sleep paralysis, horrible, nightmarish, demonic dreams, you name it. And that's because the person opened himself up to the demons. God allows that. And if he allows that, then you say, well, that's from the Lord. It's a matter of punishment. Of course, God will redeem you from that if you depend on the Lord. In fact, this young person that I was talking to that had this happen to him was totally redeemed from it. It was a battle. They had to learn about fighting demons. But they eventually ended up, the sleep paralysis and the evil dreams were over. And the evil spirits left. But Saul wasn't in a repentant state, and so he was open to demonic attack. He was sitting in his house with a spear in his hand, and David was playing the harp with his hand. Saul tried to pin David to the wall with a spear, but he slipped away. David slipped away out of Saul's presence so that Saul stuck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. That evil spirit was causing Saul to be envious, jealous, spiteful, and malicious. Typical characteristic of demons. Now, why did Saul keep that spear in his hand while he's listening to the harp? Well, it could be he kept the spear at hand to defend himself. He's paranoid now, right? So he figures, well, if somebody comes to get me, I'll get them first. Or it could be that he kept the spear at hand so that he could kill David at his first opportunity. Hard to say, but David keeps on playing. David's very humble to do this. He was an important man in the kingdom. It was really beneath his station to be playing music for Saul, but he kept on doing it. He was very kind to do it. He must have still had some affection for Saul. I would imagine so. If he had hated Saul, he would have left by now. Now, this attempt to pin David to the wall with a spear, this is the third attempt in our last chapter, 1 Samuel 18:11. We read this, Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped from his presence twice. So twice before, Saul had tried this and failed, and this was the third time. We go now to 1 Samuel 19, verses 11 through 13. Then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be put to death. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. Michal took the household idol and laid it on the bed and put a quilt of goat's hair at its head and covered it with clothes. The timing of this, then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him. That's probably at night. Saul apparently was listening to David play the harp in the evening, and then Saul immediately sent messengers to David's house that night to watch him, to put him to death in the morning. Why in the morning? Well, because David might hear those soldiers breaking in, and David could escape. It's easier to escape at nighttime than in the daytime because the attackers can't see the prey. And also, the people breaking into David's house might kill the wrong person. If they're not careful, they could kill Michal, Saul's daughter, by accident. So it makes sense that they would wait until the morning. Now, Michal, David's wife, that's Saul's daughter, how did she know that Saul's men were coming? Well, she could have seen the messengers watching outside the house, Saul's messengers. Or it could be that Jonathan may have sent her a message to give her a heads up. Or maybe she could have deduced it from the fact that Saul had just tried to kill David. I'm sure she probably heard this. Well, Saul's at it again. He just threw a spear at David. My husband. Because word like that would get around in the court, I would imagine. But at any rate, she knew they were coming. And any suspicions that she might have gotten by Saul's actions, even if she had not heard directly from Jonathan that there was a warrant to kill David, so to speak, even if she had not known that firsthand, her knowledge of Saul's actions toward David in the past would intensify any suspicions that she had. After all, Saul had tried to kill him twice before, her husband. Now, we will see these events unfold here, but let's note something sort of interesting. Gill and Clark both say that David wrote Psalm 59 because of this incident. I'll read the first three verses of Psalm 59. Deliver me from my enemies, my God. Protect me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from those who practice sin, and save me from men of bloodshed. Look, look, they set an ambush for me. Powerful men attack me, but not because of any sin or rebellion of mine. It does sound an awful lot like this incident. Powerful men attack me, they set an ambush. Verse 12, Michael lets David down through a window. That's probably a window in the back where the messengers couldn't see. They were probably watching at the front. Now, Michael, this same Michael who's going to mock David when he comes back as king, rejoicing when the ark was brought back into Jerusalem, that famous scene where she makes fun of him and David's dancing. Well, now we see that she's an idolater. She's got a household idol. So she's not exactly the best wife for David, let's admit it. I think Abigail was a lot better. I don't want to make an application of this to say if your first wife ain't so good, go find another one. That's not allowed anymore. But they had polygamy back then. But at any rate, she might have been an idolater, and she might have made fun of David at a later time. But here she saved his life. So you got to remember that. Her record is not all to the debit side. She took the household idol. Now, you could say that David knew about that idol, and so he was involved in idolatry, but I don't think so. I think most people think that if David had known about that household idol, he never would have allowed it. Michael's probably doing this secretly. Now, what was the purpose of putting the idol in the bed, put a quilt over it, and then put goat's hair at the head of the idol and covering the idol with clothes? I don't know whether that's garment that you wear or it's bedclothes. It doesn't matter. The point is that idol was dressed up to look like David was sleeping in the bed. Now, you might ask, how is that going to stop the murderers who had been dispatched to take out David? Well, apparently Michael's idea was to make it look like David was sick. Then the messengers would leave him there. Might have seemed cowardly to kill a sick man. And besides, David was a big shot in the kingdom. You're going to kill a big shot in the kingdom while he's lying in bed sick? I think it's a pretty good idea Michael had. As a matter of fact, the first messengers of Saul were actually deceived, as Jameson, Foster, and Brown point out. They kept at a respectable distance. They eventually, of course, discovered the ruse. This is Jameson, Foster, and Brown's speculation. Now, the hair that was spread out at the idol's head was probably meant to resemble David's hair, and Jameson, Foster, and Brown speculate that the hair was spread out to look like a sick person's hair. Very clever. 1 Samuel 19, verses 14 through 17. When Saul sent messengers to David, Michael, said to the messengers, "He is sick." Then Saul sent messengers to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me on his bed, that I may put him to death." Well, what happened here is the messengers go back to David and says, "Well, we didn't take him because he's sick." That's not mentioned, but that we can infer that. And then in verse 15, Saul sent messengers, maybe new messengers or maybe the old messengers, back to David and said, "Okay, look." He tells the messengers, "Go get him, bring him up to me on his bed so that I may put him to death." On his bed, if he has to be lying down when I kill him, that's fine, but bring him here. Either he walks or he's lying down on a stretcher. I don't care, but bring him to me. When the messengers entered, this is on the return trip from Saul, the second time they had left Saul. When the messengers entered, behold, the household idol was on the bed with a quilt of goat's hair at its head. So Saul said to Michael, "Why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he has escaped?" And Michael said to Saul, "He said to me, that's David said to me, Michael, let me go. Why should I put you to death?" In other words, David is threatening Michael with death. He said, "You better let me go. If you don't let me go, I'm going to kill you." And Michael's saying, "Hey, I value my life. That's why I let him go." It's a pretty good answer, actually, even though it was a lie. Well, Michael's strategy didn't work perfectly, but it did slow Saul's murderers down long enough so David could get out and escape to Ramah to see Samuel. It did work. It didn't completely work so that the messengers were totally bamboozled as to where David was, but it did slow them down. I mentioned that these first messengers would be reluctant to kill the sick David in his bed, and that's why they went back to Saul. I mentioned that's because David was such a big shot in the kingdom. He's famous. He's popular. They didn't want to kill somebody famous and popular. And I mentioned that it might have looked cowardly on their part to kill a sick man. But also, Michael was the king's daughter. So they would be killing the husband of the king's daughter. So no wonder they were a little bit gun-shy about killing David on his sick bed, on his alleged sick bed. Now, when Saul finally gets to Michael, Saul might have followed the messengers to David's house so he could kill him there on the spot, or maybe at some time later Michael went back to Saul's house. All of this is in Gibeah, of course, right north of Jerusalem. But whenever they got together, Saul confronts his daughter, a little father-daughter talk. "Why did you deceive me? I'm your father. How could you do that?" Well, the answer to that question, "Why did you deceive me?" should have been obvious. She was trying to protect her husband from being unjustly murdered. "Daddy?" Saul was either stupid or arrogant to ask such a question. Well, of course he should know why Michael said that. Maybe he was expecting his daughter to be more loyal to him than David. In fact, some people speculate that the reason Saul gave Michal to David to marry him was so that Michal could then be used as a tool by Saul to disrupt David's life. But at any rate, whether Saul was genuinely surprised that Michal had deceived him, or whether he was just, generally justly surprised, or whether he was just stupid and arrogant and didn't realize why, and either way, he was snookered. Now, here's an ethical question. Was Michal justified in lying to her father? What she said, she completely made up. David never threatened her with death. Let me go, Michal, or I'm going to kill you. He never did that. She lied about it. Was she justified? Well, here's a split of opinion on that, as these questions always do. They give a split of opinion. The option number one says that no, she was not justified. She hurt David's reputation in order to protect her life. Hurting David's reputation? Why? Because David said, I'm going to kill you if you don't let me go. I'm going to kill my own wife. Yeah, that probably didn't make David look too good. But on the other hand, it did. It saved Michael's life. Well, these people that say that she shouldn't have lied say that she should have proclaimed David's innocence. She should have said to Saul, look, the man has done nothing wrong to you. He's played the harp for you. He's killed the Philistines for you. He killed Goliath for you. That's why I let him go. Well, I got a point. But I always am wary of people urging other people on to heroic actions that might get those other people killed. I mean, it's real easy to say, you should have done that. But, you know, this is a hard place she's in. Saul was insane. He was trying to kill her. So I think she was perfectly justified. I realize that's a big ethical question. There's all kind of cases where people lie in the scriptures under duress, not just willy-nilly to their own benefit, of course, but to save other people's lives. In this case, it was to save her own life, but stop Saul from... Well, it might not have saved her life. It saved punishment coming from Saul. Let's put it that way. I don't have any problem with her doing that. If you do, that's all right. You can think bad thoughts about Michal. It's okay. We go now to 1 Samuel 19:18. Now David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he, David, and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. Now why did David run and go to Samuel? Well, that's only logical. Samuel had anointed David as the future king, and it sure didn't look like David was going to be king now. David might have gone to Samuel and said, Samuel, you remember that prophecy you gave me down there at my daddy's house in Bethlehem? You anointed me, said I was going to be king. Well, explain that to me now. I'm the king of Israel is trying to kill me. How am I going to be king? And that just goes to show a lot of times God's word in the natural doesn't look like it's going to come to pass, but it does come to pass. We just got to wait for it. And sometimes the waiting can be very, very tough, but that is faith, the essence of things not seen. But anyway, David goes to see Samuel. He needed encouragement, and Samuel is, of course, a guy who would give encouragement. Now, Ramah, of course, is right north of Jerusalem. It's right north of Gibeah, as a matter of fact. Let me look at the map here. We got Jerusalem. You go up about, maybe 3 or 4 miles, you get to Gibeah on the road, going straight north from Jerusalem. Keep going on that road, go another 2 miles, 3 miles, maybe you get to Ramah. And that's where David fled. He ran about 2 or 3 miles from Gibeah to Ramah to see Saul. And then Samuel and David left Ramah and stayed in Naoth. Now, according to BibleAtlas.org, Naoth is another mile or so up that same road, and it's right at Mizpah, the famous place where they had the Battle of Mizpah. If you recall, a big congregation, the Israel repented, Samuel presiding over that confab, Mizpah. And then there was the Battle of Mizpah. There's other Mizpahs, but this is the Mizpah that's north of Ramah. When Naoth is apparently right in the general vicinity. Now, at this place, Naoth, where Samuel and David are saying, there was Saul's country home. In other words, it's kind of hard to say it's a country home. Ramah is pretty country in itself, but anyway, it's outside of Ramah. That's just where Saul was staying. Samuel had a school for prophets there, it is thought, and David may have thought Saul was not likely to attack at Naoth because there's prophets there. But actually, Saul did try to get David at Naoth, as we'll see in just a minute. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 19, verses 19 and 20. It was told Saul, saying, behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah, means in the vicinity of Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to take David, but when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, with Samuel standing and presiding over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. I think this is a great scene here. The name Naoth signifies pasture, or some people say it signifies pasture or pleasant places. W. Ewing at BibleAtlas.org is contrary to that. He says, quote, "The term has often been taken as meaning houses or habitations, but this cannot be justified. There's no certainty as to exactly what the word signified." All right, so Naoth, the place name. It's famous. The only reason it's known is because there was a school of the prophets there. It's worth remembering for that reason. I say school of the prophets. It says right here in verse 19, the company of the prophets, but it sounds like Samuel's there. He's probably teaching those prophets how to prophesy and they're praying to God and so forth. But the Holy Spirit was so heavy and thick there that the messengers of Saul, they were not exactly really religious people. They were not really prophets, but they were so overcome by the Spirit of God, they started prophesying. Now, what exactly were they prophesying? Well, they could have been singing praises to God. They could have been foretelling future events. For example, maybe even predicting that David would be king. That would be cool. Messengers coming up to kill him, and then the prophets come out and say, and then all of a sudden those same messengers are sent to kill David or prophesying, no, David's going to be king. I guess they could hear their own prophecies and they realize, well, you know, there's something here bigger than us. We better lay off of David. Well, Saul didn't mind that the place was holy. He wanted to kill David. He not only sent this company of messengers to David, he sent two more. We go now to 1 Samuel 19, verses 21 through 24. When it was told Saul that his messengers had started prophesying and had not captured David, when it was told Saul, Saul sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. So Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah and came as far as the large well that is in Sikkoh, and he asked and said, where are Samuel and David? This is the king now coming. Where is Samuel and David? And someone said, behold, they are at Naoth in Ramah. Now, that person that finked on Samuel and David, he must have been scared of the king. I don't know, but maybe he shouldn't have said that, but he did. So in verse 23, Saul proceeds there to Naoth and Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also, so that he went along prophesying continually until he came to Naoth and Ramah. He also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore they say, is Saul also among the prophets? Now Samuel, notice, his prophesying on the way to Naoth. Not the other messengers didn't start prophesying until they got there. Saul's on the way, verse 23. He went along prophesying continually until he came to Naoth and Ramah. So this insane guy's prophesying. He's probably, and the prophecy's probably something like this. David's going to be king. Ha ha ha. And so this murderous expedition and attempt by Saul is coming to a strange climax. Not to Saul's desire, I'm sure. Now, where is this well in Sikkoh that Saul had gone to and asked for intelligence as to where Samuel and David were? Well, it's very near Naoth. In fact, BibleAtlas.org map has Sikkoh right maybe a mile to the east of Naoth. All of this is in the northern vicinity of Ramah, very close, within a couple of miles. Sikkoh means a hill or watchtower. Easton's has it placed between Gibeah and Ramah, which is south of Ramah. BibleAtlas.org map has it north of Ramah. That just goes to show that a lot of these old commentaries, I think, didn't really have a firm grasp on where things were. Doesn't really matter. But you can see that David has not gotten very far from his house in Gibeah, and he's being tracked, and he's in trouble. And we're going to see for a long time Saul's going to be tracking David down. This is just the beginning. Now, the reason Saul had to ask where David and Samuel were is because his messengers had not returned. The first set of prophesying messengers, they hadn't returned and told him where David and Samuel were. So Saul had to ask. Now, in verse 24, we read that Saul also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Why did Saul lay down naked? Well, it could mean that he was completely naked, but Adam Clark says, no, what he did is he stripped off his royal robes, laid there in his tunic, his underwear, in other words, his robe-like underwear, his tunic, probably stripped off his robes, stripped off his armor, and Jameson Fawcett Brown seems to agree with that, at least they mention that as an option, and I think that's probably true. I don't think, what's the point of stripping yourself naked and prophesying? I don't know. I just think he was more comfortable to take off his armor and take off his outer robe and lie down there and prophesy all day and all night. So he was totally overwhelmed by the Spirit of God. The word got out because it became a proverb. Is Saul also among the prophets? And what that proverb meant was, How can such an evil man like Saul be prophesying the word of God? I've known some people, especially in the charismatic movement, who could prophesy, and they were evil. I can't think of any one particular person right now, but I've noticed that, yeah, this person's really doing some really stuff with the Lord here, but, you know, I wouldn't eat with him with the silver not locked up. That's just something that's hard to deal with, because you see somebody operating so powerfully. I remember when I was young, I was praying with a man for somebody who had a very bad back problem. And the other man was praying, and he was one of these go-getter types, leader types, and I was kind of in the background. But I got my hand on the sick person's back, the person with the bad back. I had my hand there, and this other man started praying, and all of a sudden, it was like fire, hot as it could be, just heat all through the man's back. He stands up, he says, "Oh God, my back's well." You know, so I saw the power of God work through this other guy. That guy ended up making deals with illegal syndicates. He ended up denying Christ. He ended up dying a miserable death, sick. Or he was my age. I went to school with him, and he's been dead now for several years. But oh boy, I don't know if I ever heard him prophesy, but I saw him exercise a gift of healing on somebody that was quite remarkable. I also heard him preach the gospel, and then he backslides, and so just because somebody's powerful doesn't mean they're moral. And here's a good example of this. Saul was powerfully prophesying, but he was an immoral person. I don't know why God does that. At any rate, I do know that we finished chapter 19. We're now ready to go to 1 Samuel 20, verses 1 through 42. Jonathan warns David again about Saul. Hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.